I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. COVID-19 vaccines are here, and hospital staffs, doctors, nurses, and technicians are the first in line to get vaccinated, followed by residents of nursing homes. Philadelphia received 13,650 doses of the Pfizer vaccine this week. Clearly not enough to immunize everyone in this first group, but a sign that the coronavirus pandemic could eventually be contained. Meanwhile, the country hit a worrisome milestone yesterday with Johns Hopkins reporting almost 250,000 Americans tested positive for coronavirus on Wednesday, and 3,656 people died from the disease. We begin today's show with Dr. Caroline Johnson. She's Deputy Health Commissioner of Philadelphia, a member of the Vaccine Advisory Committee, to talk about the vaccine rollout plan for the city. And Dr. Johnson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's nice to be here to talk about this important topic today.
Absolutely. So how is the rollout going so far?
The rollout has been going very smoothly, with the exception of the snowstorm that slowed things down a bit yesterday.
I was going to ask you about that, yes.
Right. We didn't really need that, but we worked around it anyways. So as you'd mentioned, we got our first allocation of vaccine, which was the Pfizer product, into Philadelphia this week. And we had made plans last week about how to divide the vaccine up to get it to the people who needed it most. And we have provided vaccine to all of the hospitals and health systems in our city. And basically, on a per capita basis, the number of employees, the number of patients served. So we tried to divide it up as fairly as we could. And we work with the hospitals to identify who their highest risk employees were. For example, everybody felt the emergency rooms were one of the highest risks for employees to be exposed. So they were brought in first to get vaccine. We've also done some rollout of vaccine to a few other groups. We've been handling this ourselves within the health department. And the main group that we're trying to reach right now are all of the agencies and pharmacies and clinics who are doing COVID testing. So they're putting themselves at high risk, and we've been offering vaccine to them out of this first allotment.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things. Looking at this first group of people, I guess the more high-risk people in Philadelphia for contracting the virus and obviously needing to be vaccinated, broadly speaking, how many people in this first group?
Well, it's big. It's big. And we've defined healthcare workers fairly broadly, meaning it's not just doctors or nurses. It's anyone who is in the environment of patients who might be infected. So this could be people delivering food. It could be people who are doing security or people doing environmental cleaning. So we have a very broad definition of healthcare workers because they're all equally exposed. And that's probably about 100,000 people in Philadelphia.
Wow.
So
wow.
It's a large group, and we don't have enough vaccine for them in this first pass.
Well, again, 13,650 doses from Pfizer. Looks like Moderna is going to be close to distributing their vaccine. Do you have any sense of a timetable about at least when this first group can be vaccinated?
When the entire group will be complete?
Like 100,000 people?
I think it's going to be at least 4 weeks. We have a sense that of how much vaccine we may be getting weekly for the next month, and I think it's going to take us at least a month to even get through this very first group.
Help us understand, and this is a new vaccine. It's messenger RNA. We actually did a show about this a couple of weeks ago, but I think it bears repeating because it's something new. How does this vaccine work?
So messenger RNA is what codes for proteins. And so the vaccine uses messenger RNA that looks like what's exactly in the COVID virus or the SARS-CoV-2. And you inject the messenger RNA into a person. The messenger RNA gets taken up into cells, and it kind of takes over the protein synthesis within the cell. that messenger RNA is coding for spike protein, which is a surface component of the SARS-CoV-2. And that spike protein, once the cells make it, that causes your body to start producing antibodies to fight off the spike protein, and that's what causes the immunity, or what produces the immunity. I think it's important that everybody understand that the messenger RNA does not interfere with the human DNA and RNA. It is only temporarily there, and it doesn't have any impact on causing changes to the human's DNA and RNA.
I mean, it's a fascinating scientific breakthrough in many ways. But what's interesting with the Pfizer vaccine is it needs to be kept in deep freeze. I believe Moderna can be refrigerated. But how much for the city of Philadelphia, how much is that a challenge to be able to keep the Pfizer vaccine so cold?
It's a challenge, and it's not just this ultra-cold that becomes a problem for us, but the shipping of the ultra-cold requires that it be packaged in almost 1,000 doses. So we can only directly ship vaccine to a hospital in those large quantities of close to 1,000 doses. What this forced us to do to be able to deal with all of the hospitals, big or small, is that the health department took possession of the vaccine and then divided it up and literally drove vaccine out to the hospital so they could immunize their staff. So there was a lot of handling and subdividing a product to make sure it got where it needed to go. Some of the large facilities have their own ultra-cold storage, and we could direct ship vaccine to them. So I would say it wasn't as much the ultra-cold storage that became the problem. It was the fact that you could only ship in these very large quantities, and we had a very small allocation of vaccine for us, so we had to do our higher math and make sure everything divided up just correctly.
That's a tough decision to make. Here's a tweet from one of our listeners. I'm over 70 with several significant health conditions, so I will be in phase one. How will I know when I can go and get my vaccines, and how do I prove that I am in phase one? Can you answer that, Dr. Johnson?
That's a question that we've been debating a lot about the last part of that, the proof. I believe that the network that will be built in the city to deal with this person's need for immunization is going to be based on pharmacies, on community clinics, and probably some special larger clinic type events that are set up just to vaccinate individuals. I don't believe this vaccine is going to be in the hands of I'll say private doctors or primary care type doctors for quite a while, probably not till we get to the point of phase three, which is a release for the general population. But it is true that people with seniors with underlying illnesses are definitely in the earliest phases of this. Our plan locally is to post this information on the website to say, here's what you can do to reach vaccine to know where it is and how to get it. Now, it will be appointment based. It is unlikely that there will be any situation where we would encourage or allow walk-ins because of the need for social distancing. We have to keep the social distancing and the masking going all through this process of distributing vaccine. So we will make all of the vaccine distribution based on appointments. I'm hoping on the website we'll be able to tell people how to make those appointments.
And what's that website, just so our listeners know?
Well, it will be www.phila.gov, and then /COVID.
COVID, okay.
That's the city's main website, and it will have a tab that is very specific about vaccines and everything people need to know.
Now, we're talking about vaccines, which really requires two doses to get the maximum protection. How will you keep track of that? Will people have a card once they get their second dose? Will they have some kind of a card that says that they have been fully vaccinated?
Yes. So the best strategy to make sure people get second doses is to give them the appointment for the second dose when they get the first dose. And that is what almost everybody is doing right now. We hand people an appointment date and time, and with the expectation that they come back. They will also be given a vaccination card that records exactly what product they got, what date they got it, and when they need the second dose. So we're, of course, we were only giving out first doses now. We don't have any experience to know what the return rate will be. But we also are going to be tracking all of these immunizations electronically. And when we find that someone did not return for a second dose, we will be doing a callback of sorts to get them in for that second dose.
And what's the goal? I mean, as you look, let's say over the next year, 2021, what percentage of the Philadelphia population would you like to be vaccinated?
Well, I'm going to say 100%.
Of course, but I mean, realistically speaking.
The realistic goal, I think we're shooting for 70%. Okay. And that number is based on a little bit on what we know we can achieve, because we get very high immunization rates in the city for most vaccines, especially among children. And that's the number where we believe herd immunity is going to occur. And that's the phenomenon where you protect people from this infection, regardless of whether they receive the vaccine.
You mentioned children, though. And are children going to be vaccinated against COVID?
Children are not eligible right now. The Pfizer vaccine, on the emergency use authorization, the age cutoff was 16. So you can only vaccinate people 16 and above. Basically, that's just telling us that the vaccine wasn't tested in younger people. It doesn't mean it's not safe. We just don't know because it hasn't been tested. Many of the other trials that are going on or about to go on are going to enroll children. So we will have information on safety and efficacy in that group. And I do expect them to eventually be eligible for vaccination, but not till phase three.
And final question to you, do Philadelphians, frankly, everybody, do we still need to wear masks and socially distance even if we've been vaccinated?
Absolutely. It is, first of all, no vaccine is 100% effective. This one's very good. It's said to be 95% effective, but that's not 100%. So to protect yourself and to protect others, you still want to socially distance and wear masks. I think it's going to take all these pieces of prevention to defeat this pandemic and get back to normal.
Well, Dr. Caroline Johnson, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times, getting our conversation started. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's Deputy Health Commissioner of Philadelphia, a member of the Vaccine Advisory Committee. And coming up after this very short break, how communities of color have been hit hard by this virus, what healthcare providers are doing to ensure that everyone gets the treatment and care that they need. And you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. African Americans and Latinos have been hit especially hard by the pandemic, with high rates of infections, of hospitalizations, and of dying from COVID-19. And for a whole host of reasons, which we'll talk about, they're also more hesitant about getting vaccinated. Here's Sandra Lindsay. She's a critical care nurse at Long Island Jewish Medical Center, who was born in Jamaica and the first person in the United States to be vaccinated against coronavirus.
I am hopeful. I feel hopeful today. Relieved. I feel like healing is coming. I hope this marks the beginning to the end of a very painful time in our history. I want to instill public confidence that the vaccine is safe. We're in a pandemic, and so we all need to do our parts. to put an end to the pandemic.
Today in Radio Times, we look at the racial health disparities that the pandemic has revealed, what's being done to address the inequities in the healthcare system, and how to ensure that at-risk communities are getting the care that they need. And joining us is Dr. Ayla Stanford. She's a pediatric surgeon, also founder of the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium, which is based in Philadelphia, providing free testing for the virus. And Dr. Stanford, we've wanted to have you on for a long time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us by Skype is Dr. Florence Montplaisir. She's an assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases and associate chief of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at the Perelman School of Medicine. That's at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also a fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute, and she's done focus groups with Black barbershops and Black salons. And Dr. Montplaisir, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're very welcome. I'm thrilled to have both of you here. And Dr. Stanford, if I could begin with you and just give you a chance to respond to what Sandra Lindsay said. This was earlier this week, the first person in the United States to be vaccinated, a woman of color from Jamaica. I found and a fascinating person herself. But what was your takeaway from her message?
It's a sentiment that I share. You know, having received the vaccine yesterday.
Oh, you did?
I did. And you don't expect the emotion. You know, there's some fear. I think that's natural. You go through the questions, you give consent, and then the vaccine. And for myself and my staff who have been testing people, ironically, exactly 9 months, because we started April 16th yesterday, We just held each other and cried because we've seen so much death. We've seen family members pass away. You know, we've taken care of a lot of sick folks. And in that moment, it was just a relief for the possibility of getting to brighter days.
So tears of joy from, or probably tears of all sorts of emotions.
Yeah.
Let me turn to you, Doug. Yeah, and I'm sorry, I'm jumping all over you as you're talking there. Let me turn to you, Dr. Montplaisir.
Okay.
And I'm interested in the work that you have done, and you've been doing some of these trials, encouraging people of color to be part of these vaccine trials. What is that involved? What has that entailed for you?
So I think in order to get buy-in, particularly from the Black community who's been marginalized and has well-founded fears regarding medical research, is to show that African Americans have been involved at very high levels of the vaccine development process and the rollout process. And part of that is participation in clinical trials. It's hard to go to a community where distrust is high and say, well, we've developed this effective vaccine, but people like you were not included in the trials, but we know it's effective and it'll be good for you. We thought it would be important, and the NIH also felt that it was important that the pool of patients who would be involved in the clinical trials would be diverse. And I was really pleased to see that this was intentional, particularly as the majority of participants were white early on in the trials, and the NIH actually asked to slow down enrollment in order to ensure that Blacks and Hispanics and Asians were also adequately represented. So my role as part of the Penn Clinical Trials Unit was to reach out to people of color and engage them around conversation in trial participation. And we've done this through a series of town halls where instead of saying, okay, you know, enrolling my trial, we spent a lot of time providing education and helping them understand, you know, what a trial is, what it involves, what the vaccine is, and helping them become familiar with the process.
And I do want to pick up on that, but Dr. Stanford, let me go back to you, and I'm interested. You have been you and your staff have been providing free testing for COVID-19 in Philadelphia in some of these underserved communities. That has given you a chance to talk to, I'm assuming, probably thousands of people in the city who might have this suspicion or reluctance or mistrust or distrust of the system. Help us understand that.
Magnificent question. So we have, and in about October, we added a psychometric tool, fancy word for survey, and we queried 800 people about their attitudes and perceptions surrounding receiving a coronavirus vaccine. And what we found that 72% of folks thought it was made too fast, thought that they might not wanted to wait to see before other people would get it, but 44% of people said they would get it today. And what that directly correlated with was if you knew someone who was very sick or died from coronavirus, which we know in African Americans is 1 in 2 people. Wow. And so those folks wanted it. What I found within my own staff, because initially only 20% of us wanted to receive the coronavirus vaccine as frontline workers, is that when I sat and I talked to each one of them individually, or sometimes in a group of 3 or 4, and they could share with me what their true fear was, most of them decided to take the vaccine.
I mean, obviously you're taking the time to talk to find out, where is this coming from? Where is this mistrust coming from?
Absolutely. And for me, you know, a lot of folks, they said, "Doc, when you tell me it's okay to get the vaccine, I'll roll up my sleeves. When you tell me it's okay, I'll take it." So it's also leading by example and from a trusted individual that you say, you know what, if she's going to do it, I'm okay. Some people are okay with that. But other folks, you just have to say back, you know, say her name is Jen. Jen, you're 60 years old. You're overweight. You're African American. You have high blood pressure, and you work in a COVID ward every day that you go to work. So is your risk greater to get coronavirus, or is your risk greater to receive the vaccine? And you just put it in front of them. And she knew in that moment that she had a higher chance of not doing well and potentially dying with coronavirus than she did with the vaccine. And then she decided to take it.
And fascinating. Dr. Monplaisir, let me go back to you, because I know that you've done some focus groups with black barbershops, black salons. Again, a chance to talk to people to find out where some of this mistrust has come from. I know some of it is historic, involving Tuskegee and other experiments on black Americans. But I wonder whether there's something about this particular virus and even vaccine because of the politicized year that we have been living through. Can you speak to that?
Oh, absolutely. I think there was a lot of reluctance due to the fact that people linked the vaccine to the Trump administration, which for the most part was overseen as the picture of white supremacy. So there was a lot of skepticism about, okay, so why you're coming in our community and giving us this vaccine when in reality we're seeing, our family members being mistreated and dying in the hands of police officers. So there was a lot of concern and mistrust around the process, particularly with the flip-flopping of the FDA and also the CDC with testing recommendations. So they felt very confused and felt that they didn't really know where to go to have a trusted voice through this process. And I'm hoping that with the change of administration, that perhaps some of the skepticism is going away. But it was at the time very fresh in people's minds.
Dr. Stanford, you mentioned the fact that you and your staff got the vaccine yesterday, but I wonder how important it is for trusted people, whether it's a minister or President Obama or Michelle Obama. I'm thinking of all the people that have, you know, enormous credibility, how important it is for them to be vaccinated and vaccinated in a very public way.
I think all of it helps. I think for some, and, you know, I love President Obama, but for some, that's not going to be enough because right. people have already said, well, what they give to President Obama, that's not what they're giving to me, you know? And so that's where your barbers, your pastors, your hairdressers, your funeral directors, your teachers, people in the community, the tangible folks that you know and trust, that's where it matters. You know, and what I said yesterday after I got my vaccine is, I'm not asking people to forget about Dr. Sims, Tuskegee, Holmesburg Prison, Henrietta Lack, and for that matter, coronavirus in 2020. But what I am saying is don't allow those experiences that have happened block you right now from receiving something that could save your life and get you back to our new normal. And I remind them, you know, 20,000 people already received this vaccine, the majority of whom were white, right? And now you have folks like myself and the doctor and the National Medical Association and the American Medical Association that are all watching these things, and independent physicians and observers and so forth, that we are not going to allow things that happened of the past to be repeated, that this is a new day, and not to take away from the pain that you feel and the mistrust that was garnered, but to use that to say, I will make sure it won't happen again in my lifetime.
And just to add to the sort of emergency nature of this, I'll go back to you, Dr. Stanford, because you are a clinician. And I said in my introduction, and both of you referenced the fact that people of color, African-Americans, Latinos, Latinas, are at greater risk for contracting this virus and getting sick from it and even dying.
That's absolutely right. And just bringing up that point that when it's your turn to take it, and again, these are healthcare workers that I have to remind that of the healthcare workers that perished, 63% of them were of color, the majority of whom were African American. So don't block it when it's here. I mean, people are trying to get it illegally. Don't block it because of the past, you know, and you got to have one-on-one, meet people where they are, understand what their fears are, and then give them the information. And they can make an informed decision. And I found in our group, I said, I think we started at 20%. Now mm-hmm. we're well over 50%. And even wow. half of us getting it yesterday is going to give them the courage they need to get it on Sunday when the remainder of our staff, because, you know, my arm felt sore. It feels much better now. My stomach felt queasy. That's completely gone. I have no fever. I feel like myself. And that's going to be helpful as people hear how we're doing after having received it.
Dr. Monplaisir, let me go back to you and help us understand why African Americans are at greater risk for contracting this virus, being greatly sickened by the virus and even dying from it. Why those higher numbers?
Yeah, and there are multiple factors that are contributing to this, but primarily African Americans tend to be in jobs where they are in the front line, and I just heard that firsthand from some of my patients, particularly early on in the pandemic, where they were going to work and not providing appropriate PPEs. Or appropriate protection. The fact that a lot of individuals in our communities have comorbid conditions that are not very well controlled due to structural racism and lack of access to care, and particularly during this pandemic where a lot of people have lost their jobs, but particularly the African-American community has been hard hit by this pandemic economically. You know, not having health insurance, worrying about going to the hospital because they're worried about exposure, even though they feel sick. All of these things, I think, contributed to the disparities that we're seeing, both in terms of exposure but also in terms of disease severity.
Well, and what you also seem to be saying is with this health crisis, we've got an economic crisis, which is exacerbating the health crisis, Dr. Monplaisir.
That is correct. That is correct, because one feeds into the other. And, you know, it just makes me think that hopefully people at the higher level are thinking about these things and providing protection for workers, for people who lost their jobs and still need access to care in the middle of the pandemic.
Let me turn back to you, Dr. Stanford. And again, going back to first of all, I should ask you, how many people have you tested in Philadelphia?
Oh, wow. 20,000.
20,000.
Yeah, over 20,000. And, you know, on one hand, I'm very proud of that. But on the other hand, you know, I'm a private practice pediatric surgeon, you know, on staff at Abington Jefferson. And why is it that it had to take someone who was basically at home sheltering in place in the living room in my pajamas to say, this is crazy, this has to change, and do something, where we have institutions that have been here for centuries that did not mobilize as quickly. And we just need to do better. We need to do better. We were a gap to fill a void, and it's 9 months later, and we're still here. You know, and obviously I'm committed, my team is committed to seeing us to that 70%, 75% herd immunity. And we want to see that and be a part of people having an opportunity to get the treatment they need after testing and having the contact tracing. But I just feel like the institutions that had way more resources and infrastructure than us should have been making a more impactful footprint from the very beginning.
Well, I do want to pick up on that. First, a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Dr. Ayla Stanford. She's a pediatric surgeon, as she said, and founder of the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium based here in Philadelphia. Also with us, Florence Monplaisir. She's an infectious disease physician and scientist at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Let me just recap what we're talking about. Communities of color have been hit hard by the pandemic, maybe even harder than most other communities, at greater risk of contracting the virus, of becoming very sick, and sadly dying of COVID-19. There's also reluctance to get immunized in many Black and brown communities, although as we're hearing, there are ways to address this. We're looking at the roots of some of these racial disparities, what can be done to provide the care that's needed. And again, our guests are Dr. Ayla Stanford. She's a pediatric surgeon, founder of the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium based in Philadelphia. Dr. Florence Monplaisir is a Penn Medical School researcher. She's done focus groups at Black barbershops and salons, and she's also recruited people of color for vaccine trials. And again, you can join us as we're talking about today on Radio Times. You can join us, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Dr. Stanford, let me just pick up on what you were talking about right before the break. Sure. And it's really how this consortium, how it got started, what you were responding to, and how it works. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. So lots of friends were calling me. You know, I'm from Philadelphia, born and raised. I have lots of roots and family, and saying that they were trying to get tested for coronavirus and they were being turned away. And they're largely African-American educated with insurance. And so I was calling emergency departments. I'm Dr. Stanford, calling on behalf of X patient. They need a coronavirus test, and this is why. And when I did that, they were able to get the test. But the person showing up with a script could not get a test, even though it was from their physician. And when I reached out to the city and state, and I'm on staff at Abington Jefferson, and I asked, you know, why are we turning people away? It was because they weren't in cars and people came on foot. Well, we're largely a commuter city, so a lot of folks were turned away for that. They didn't have a state-issued ID, no health insurance, they weren't over 65, they weren't a healthcare worker, they hadn't traveled. The appointments were scheduled during the day, and as you heard Dr. Montplaisir say, most folks are face-front employees working, and so it really wasn't geared towards the population that was being most affected. And so I created this barrier-free testing where you didn't need all of those things I just mentioned, and it was free. And so I paid for all of those tests initially until the CARES Act was passed. I paid for them. And if folks had a copay with their insurance, I waived the copay. The test was $150, and people were dying, showing up at the hospital front door only to die or get intubated and die shortly thereafter because they were told to stay home until you think you need to be admitted to the hospital. And so we have to do better, and it's somewhat better. But still, everyone in the city that needs a test cannot get one.
Do you have funding now? Do you have funding to cover some of these costs?
So we do have funding to cover some. You know, it's a constant, you know, me sort of beating the pavement for sustainable dollars for us. The Philadelphia Department of Public Health has partnered with us, and Dr. Farley, I speak to multiple times a week. And so that partnership has gone a long way. But it's a tough predicament that we're in because the hospitals are taking care of everyone else. And now this surge on top of surge from coronavirus. And unfortunately, all those mobile testing centers are shut down with inclement weather and because of winter months. And so everyone is coming to us now of all ethnicities, not just Black and Latinx, but you know, white and anyone who needs a test because they're just hard to come by in the city. And so I just wish there was a more concerted effort that on Monday and Tuesday, you could go to Penn. Wednesday and Thursday, you could go to Jefferson. Friday and Saturday, you could go to CHOP. And people knew that those were the places you could go. And I tried to push for that in the city with Dr. Farley, but it didn't come to fruition. And, you know, certain states, California, you can get tested all day. You go online, you go into a system, they don't ask you any of those questions. You just schedule it, you show up, and you get a test. We need to do better.
Absolutely. That's Dr. Ayla Stanford. And again, she's founder of the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium in Philadelphia. Let me turn back to you, Dr. Montplaisir. And what we're hearing from, frankly, both of you is just how the pandemic has revealed these really systemic problems in our healthcare system. When it comes to Black and brown patients, obviously, it has unearthed a lot of old feelings of mistrust and distrust. And I wonder whether you feel we can address some of the problems in our healthcare system faced with the crisis that we are.
Yeah, and actually, I agree with what Dr. Stanford says. I think early on in the pandemic, there were many structural barriers, and testing was one of them that resulted in the disparities that we saw early on. As the infrastructure improved, and particularly thanks to Dr. Stanford's work and the health department's work, the disparities in testing actually decreased significantly and now are unfortunately widening again. But we cannot repeat the same mistakes for the vaccine. We need to do better, and we can do better if we spend time planning and thinking and working together. I think for this to work, there needs to be input and collaboration from everyone. Large academic center, community centers, the health department, physicians, the community, in order to make it happen. From what I hear when having our community discussions around the COVID-19 vaccine is the concern that the mRNA vaccine, which is more effective, will be distributed across large academic centers who have the infrastructure for storage of the vaccines.
Right.
But that perhaps, you know, people are afraid that the AstraZeneca vaccine, which again hasn't been FDA approved yet, but has been shown to be less effective at 62%, because it doesn't require the low level temperatures for storage and is more easily distributed, would be more widely distributed in communities where, you know, access to such storage is not available. So I think we need to be very cautious. I think people are watching to see how this rollout and the allocation and of vaccines will be done equitably in the city. And I think there's an opportunity there to get it right.
Well, and the logistics are just can feel very overwhelming. But let me go back to you, Dr. Stanford. How important, though, is transparency? And I know when the Vaccine Advisory Committee for the FDA met, people could sit and watch them discuss. Mm-hmm. And this is the Pfizer vaccine. They could watch them discuss the pros and cons and, frankly, look at them make their decision to, yes, roll this out sooner rather than later. How important is that, that we know that we and how do we get that message out in a way that really resonates with people?
So serving on the committee with Caroline Johnson, who I heard you had on earlier, mm-hmm. you know, we talked about this a lot yesterday with our next groups, our 1B and 1C folks, just making it very clear the process, certifying people, if you will, sort of committing them, saying, do you want the vaccine? And if so, mm-hmm. What are the reasons why you feel you should have it now? Just sort of a commitment, like a pre-commitment before the vaccine is available. And we have to use the churches, the labor unions, the block captains, the leaders of the mosques. Like, you have to, because a lot of people aren't on, you know, don't have phones and Wi-Fi, and there's this digital divide, and there's this whole group of people that would be excluded, right? And so we're going to have to look at our mapping, look at our zip codes, where the positivity rates were the highest, and make sure that folks have an opportunity when the vaccine is available for them to get it. And that starts now, while we're doing the phase 1A people, so that when it drops here, literally drops and is delivered, we're ready with a plan to deploy it and get it out to those who need it most.
And Dr. Montplaisir, is that your dog, Dr. Stanford?
I apologize.
No, that's okay.
He's crazy.
I love dogs.
In the snow.
That's okay.
Let me find him.
That's okay. I'm going to go to Dr. Montplaisir. But I'm curious, too, about how much we're all up against misinformation or disinformation or even conspiracy theories, you know, whether understandable or not. How much do you think that's a challenge or a problem? And I'm interested even in some of the focus groups that you did, whether that came up at all.
Yeah, so that actually came up, not so much in the focus groups, but with the work that we've been doing, engaging faith-based leaders around vaccine acceptance. And our goal, because there's a lot of mistrust against the vaccine, and our goal is to, at least if we can move the needle toward hesitancy and then eventually acceptance, would be great. And as Dr. Stanford mentioned, it's important to work with gatekeepers in the community, people that others look up to receive trusted information. So we spend a lot of time engaging in a series of town halls to involve faith leaders and their communities and really educating them on, okay, so what is an mRNA and how does it work? How does it go in the cell and how is it destroyed, you know, after the spike protein is produced? Because there's a lot of fears about the fact that it's, first of all, a new virus, it's a new vaccine. The mRNA vaccine, although it's been tested among different infectious diseases, it hasn't been rolled out in clinical trials in such a large scale. So this is new. And people have, you know, fears about getting genetically engineered from the mRNA vaccine. That's why I really love the fact that Dr. Johnson earlier mentioned that the mRNA doesn't go in the nucleus. It doesn't interact with one's DNA. So basically just breaking down those myths through education is important. There's also a lot of fears about using fetal cells to engineer the vaccine, which is not the case. So it's important to understand where people are, what they're thinking about, and just providing the information so that they can make an informed decision around taking the vaccine.
And do you find that faith leaders want to do this and they're interested? And obviously a lot of churches either are socially distancing or they're online or not meeting at all. But do you find, Dr. Monplaisir, that faith leaders want to get involved?
Oh, they absolutely want to get involved, and they feel a sense of responsibility to get it right and to tell their congregation the right thing. Obviously, they are not medical professionals, but their community is coming to them for guidance, and they are eager to educate themselves and provide the right information or point to resources that people can go to have their questions answered.
Dr. Stanford, here's a comment from Christine, who says many people of color live below the poverty level. They often live in cramped apartments or apartments holding multi-generations. Thus, there's no ability to socially distance or to quarantine oneself. Poverty plays a part in infections. Can you speak to that?
I agree with you 100%. These are the social determinants of health that, unfortunately, I learned about 23 years ago when I graduated from medical school and are still pervasive. I can mention that the city of Philadelphia did have and still has, to my knowledge, locations for people to quarantine that are in homes that are multi-generational, and it's impossible to isolate when you have someone who's positive. We use those services a lot. Certainly the bill that's on the floor right now to be passed with hopefully some COVID relief will assist in that. And I have told folks to reach out to us, www.blackdoctorsconsortium.com. We have a contact information line, and we do have access to some resources. So I would encourage folks to reach out to us, and we can do our best to help and or advocate for you.
And just final question to you, Dr. Stanford, and it's kind of a big one, so I apologize for that. But
okay.
why has this Tuskegee syphilis study, this goes back to what, to the early 1950s, why has that had such a powerful effect on African Americans in this country?
That's actually easy. And
okay,
why people correlate it with the coronavirus vaccine, it was a syringe with a substance that got injected into your arm. And you know that it was a disease being injected to watch the progression of disease to see what you would look like when you got to tertiary syphilis, which was the most severe form. And so now, coupled with coronavirus vaccine, which is why a lot of African Americans won't get a flu vaccine, for example, but coupled with, it's that same mental image and picture. And what I have said to folks is that I know that happened. And as a Black woman in a healthcare professional, it's a tough place to be. I am sort of in the middle. I'm torn by science and I'm torn by my cultural norms and how I was raised. But this is a real pandemic. People are dying. I think I heard a person every 30 seconds are dying. And we African Americans are disproportionately dying. So I'm not asking you to dismiss. I'm not asking you to forgive. I'm not asking you to put it in your back pocket and say, you've got to move on. But what I am saying is, in this real-time crisis, you don't want to be the statistic of another person that contracted the disease and or died.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you for the work that you're doing. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. Dr. Ayla Stepford, thanks so much for finally got you on the show.
Yay.
And she's a pediatric surgeon, founder of the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium. And Dr. Florence Monplaisir, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's an infectious disease physician and scientist. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.